specific issues like stem cell research. This is one of the most promising lines of research in biology, and yet we have college-educated politicians blocking, to a large degree, impeding this research on the basis of dogmas, specifically now a dogma that the soul enters the zygote at the moment of conception, dogmas that have no basis in fact, no basis in sensory or logical evidence, and we can't even criticize their points of view because faith is sacred in our culture.
That's Sam Harris again in an interview talking about his book, The End of Faith. We're reviewing that book with Dr. Doug Guybert. During the next half hour of Issues Etc., we invite your questions and your comments, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Guybert is professor of philosophy at Talbot School of Theology. He's author of several books, including his latest, In Defense of Miracles. He's written an article in the Christian Research Journal titled The End of Reason, Secularism, Paranoia, and the Folly of Sam Harris. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's go to the phones. We'll talk with Matt. He's listening in Palm Bay, Florida. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Todd. Hi, Dr. Guybert.
Guybert. Yeah.
Guybert. Okay. I knew I would get it wrong. I apologize. Tell me, as part of the premise of Sam Harris's book, the idea that people who are who believe in immortality or the afterlife and aren't really afraid of death are dangerous?
Interesting, Matt. Thank you very much for the call. Dr. Guybert?
Well, yes, he thinks that religious believers in general are dangerous, and it's because they believe things like that, not just those kinds of things, but things like that, because obviously they have this otherworldly point of view that makes life in the here and now seem less important, less precious, and less valuable, and so more easily dispensable. Of course, one of the problems with that is that from the religious point of view, at least if it's a Christian point of view, human beings are created in the image of God, in the likeness of God. They have souls that make them especially precious and valuable in this life and for the next life, so that you've got a lot of pro-life activism among Christians and other religious believers today precisely because of the things that they believe. So there's an odd tension there that I haven't heard Sam Harris actually address directly.
Steve calls from his car. Steve, thanks for waiting and welcome.
How does the author of this book handle the fact that in the 20th century, some of the greatest mass murderers, Hitler, Stalin, Pol Pot, even Mao Zedong in China, they're all atheistic in nature, and the fact that liberals, secularists gave us eugenics in the 1920s and forced sterilization. How does he handle that in the book?
Thank you,
well,
Steve.
Sorry about that to cut in. That is an excellent question again, and I have to say that he doesn't deal very much with that question directly at all. It's an excellent question. If you're going to argue that many of the problems that we have in the world today, social problems, problems of foreign policy, problems of warfare from the Crusades and right on up into the present wars, the war on terrorism and the war from terrorists, if you're going to say all of that is based in one's religious point of view, then you're right to wonder, well, then what about these other serious problems that were perpetrated by people who had an utterly atheistic and secular worldview? I mean, if you're going to run the argument one way, you're open to the query, why doesn't it work in the other way as well? It sounds like special pleading when you say the worldview of a Christian explains his behavior in the world, but the worldview of a secularist or an atheist who does horrible things has nothing to do with his behavior.
Right. I mean, if someone's worldview is inherently dangerous, the burden falls upon the person making that that case to show that dangers that occur under other worldviews didn't result because
that's right.
Communism rejected the view of God entirely or something like
that. And how would you show something like that? You've got the general problem of showing that what one believes is the full explanation for how one behaves. But quite often, our behavior belies what we say we believe. In other words, it turns out that we don't behave consistently with what we say we believe, but it's actually a manifestation of what we really believe, which is different than what we tell other people, maybe even than what we tell ourselves. And so I agree that if Christians or any other religious believers do horrible things and terrorize others, then they need to be called to account. But I don't see how what they do is grounded in what they say they believe, and it might be evidence that they don't believe what they say they believe.
So in that vein, is he willing to permit that the great many evils he lists perpetrated by religion in general and Christianity in particular are in fact signs of or instances of profound Christian hypocrisy or Christians acting outside what they ought to believe? Is he willing to permit that at all?
Well, he actually veers away from that. You might recall from reading the review that I wrote that he doesn't really accuse Christians of being hypocrites when they behave badly, because he thinks that it follows naturally and almost insistently, automatically, from what they believe, that they will behave this way. So if they're acting consistent with what they believe, they're not being hypocrites, they're just being bad people because they believe bad things. So he doesn't really follow that particular tactic.
Does he ever explain why he believes that there is no free will and why he asserts that?
Yeah, he explains why in terms of the physiology of the human person, which is all there is to being a human person. We are just physical stuff, bodies, very complex to be sure, with brains and very powerful and impressive processes and mechanisms that explain human behavior, but nothing that could be called consciousness independently of the chemical changes that go on inside our brains. And so they're like any other physical process. They're going to be governed by the laws of nature and by the nature of the physical things themselves. So if you've got a physical state and another a physical event acts on that state, then something's going to happen, and it cannot be other than what it's going to be. It's just strictly determined by the laws of nature.
Wouldn't that include religious beliefs? I mean, it would seem logical at that point for him to argue that religion is just perhaps even a malfunction of the natural processes of the body, but in fact something that happens as a result of our physiological makeup and cannot be helped. It will happen. It's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, I think that's right. And he may well be prepared to accept that. He might say, well, that is the case. And there are people who do think that religious belief is a dysfunctional state of a physical mechanism, and maybe the people who have these beliefs can't help themselves. But it's certainly not a good thing. It's a plight on humanity to have this going on. So maybe they're not acting freely and can't do otherwise, but that's still a bad thing, that this is how they think and this is what they do. Now, the problem, of course, is that if you take that line, then when you say we need to argue and reason with each other and consider what is most reasonable on the basis of evidence, then it sounds like it's a matter of conviction that can alter as you remain sensitive to evidence, so that if you your mind is changed, not by some physical event, but by some rational reflection on data, on evidence, well, then that's up to you. So he's got both going on there. He's got an analysis of human consciousness that's purely physical, so that there's no freedom. And yet he's telling us we need to be sensitive to evidence so that we can make better decisions about how to live our lives.
He makes some attempt, according to your review, to do his own version of the problem of evil, the classic problem of evil. And you say it is the one argument that he actually does attempt to make in the course of The End of Faith. Tell us how he frames his argument, and then, if you would, evaluate it.
Yeah, he talks about theism as a view that entails that God created the world and all things in it. And that's his phrase, God created the world and all things in it. He says this is something that theists believe. Then the next premise is that things like smallpox, plague, another esoteric disease called filariasis, are just examples of things in the world, right? Well, then it follows that God created these things, smallpox, plague, and filariasis. So if God created these things, then God is their cause. And anyone who causes the existence of horrid things like that is morally deficient. Therefore, the God of theism is morally deficient.
Sounds like he's trying to hold God to his own standard, even though he rejects that standard.
Well, it sounds like, it could sound that way. It could be an argument that's internal to theism. In other words, he could be arguing as follows. I don't really have these moral values myself, but most theists, certainly Christians, do. And so by their own moral standards, this God is morally deficient. He could be making that kind of argument. But
so
how would you
okay, so how would you evaluate his argument? Is there a chink in what he considers to be the armor of his logic here?
Yeah, well, I was just going to say that what he's arguing instead is that he himself has these moral standards, and he's holding God accountable to them, even if Christians don't. And so he does have a moral theory that requires of God that he behave differently than he does in permitting or causing these horrible diseases, right? So one of the limitations of his argument and one of the vulnerabilities of his argument is that what he requires for it to work is something he denies by his own account of ethics and morality, his deep account of what it means to be morally good or what it means for an action to be morally right or morally wrong.
Do you think the average reader could make the distinction when reading Harris's book between, I mean, it's a bit subtle there saying, because it sounds as though he'd be willing to play fast and loose. Look, I don't hold these standards myself, but Christians do, therefore they got to hold their God accountable and they cannot vindicate him. But his argument is based upon a standard that he obviously believes himself. Do you think the average listener can, I mean, the average reader of the book can sort that one out?
Well, I don't know about that. That's a good question. I think I would like to see the average reader get better at reading. And having the kind of conversation that we're having, I think, helps everyone see that you have to read very carefully and you have to be very discerning about what a person is claiming on one page, what he's saying on another page, and how this is supposed to be consistent. I would be very surprised if during an interview on television or on the radio or if he and I were having a soda together, if he would actually say, no, these aren't by my standards. God is morally deficient by the standards of the Bible, by the standards of theism itself, by the standards of Christians. But by my standards, you know, it's a wash. It's all neutral, but it doesn't matter. The reason why I don't think he would say that is because the whole argument of his book depends upon two claims. Religious belief is irrational, and religious belief in its consequences is morally repugnant. It's morally defective. So I think what's driving it on the surface of the book, the surface of his presentation is, look, we're getting a horrible result from having religion in the world. We're paying a terrible cost having all this religious belief in the world. Now, it's morally repugnant, this cost that we have to incur. Now, that by itself is not enough of an argument. He's got to then say, but you know what? We can do without religious belief because it's irrational anyway. So the reason why we've got all these moral problems is because we've got all these people believing something that's utterly irrational that puts us in this position. So it's a dual argument, and he is presupposing some kind of moral ground to stand on in making this moral judgment.
Does he ever address in any way, in his book, The End of Faith, the central tenet of the Christian faith, that is, the atonement effected by Christ through his perfect life, death, and resurrection? Does he ever touch upon the event of the cross and the resurrection in his book?
I don't recall whether he touches on it some or not. He doesn't have an elaborate argument. If he says anything about the resurrection, it's probably just in passing and probably fairly dismissive, but I wouldn't say for sure that he does that. What he focuses on with respect to Christian belief, for example, is something like the doctrine of hell. He has a longer discussion of that where he just sort of ridicules the idea of hell and talks about how sinister it is for people to go around talking about hell and threatening people with hell when it's such a ridiculous notion in the first place. But you see, you can't really make sense of the Christian doctrine of hell without reference to what you just called the doctrine of the atonement of Jesus Christ, right?
So I have to ask again then, how seriously can one take his assessment of Christianity if he does not deal with its central truth claim and the truth claim which, you know, one of the proponents of Christianity, St. Paul, says, apart from the truth of this claim, nothing we believe is of any account or really makes any sense.
Well, right. That's right. I don't think he does wrestle with the core beliefs of Christians very seriously at all, or even acknowledges what counts as the core from our point of view. You know, I'm a Christian myself, and I would like to know what he thinks about the more basic beliefs that provide the foundation for the other things that we believe. I might not believe in hell either if I didn't believe in the authority of Jesus, someone who was in an extraordinary and unique position to advise us about the reality of such a place and what we can do to avoid such a destiny for ourselves. And I think it's an act of mercy on his part if he knows such a thing and he warns us about it and gives us an alternative. But he doesn't explore that. Sam Harris doesn't explore any of that. He just goes straight to this concept and this part of the preaching of Christianity and says, this is repugnant, this is irrational, it's just another reason why we should reject religion.
Another contention he makes is that the Christian ethic is designed in such a way that it only really applies when dealing with someone who shares your point of view. He seems profoundly unfamiliar with the basic moral teachings of Jesus Christ, such as love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, mm-hmm. and I think that might include even those who disagree with you as well.
You know, I'm not sure I agree with you about how familiar he is. I suspect he's more familiar than you can tell from reading his book. I mean, what are we going to do? If we're going to read him charitably and give him the benefit of the doubt, do we think, oh, he's just unfortunate in that he doesn't quite understand what Christianity is really about, and, you know, that's our charitable reading of him? Or do we say, no, a more charitable reading would be, this is a smart guy who's done a lot of research, and he's telling us that we all ought to base our claims in reason and thorough investigation. Shouldn't we then assume that he's been as thorough and complete in his research into the nature of Christianity? What's the more charitable reading? I think on either point, his neglect of the central features of Christianity and of the most basic evidential considerations in favor of Christianity is very telling.
So it is dishonest.
Well, I think I don't think we have to speculate about whether he's dishonest about the things he doesn't talk about, when you can tell that he's dishonest about some of the things he does talk about, right? So when he talks about the Crusades, for example, he likens Christian behavior during the Crusades of the 11th century, right? That was a while back. He likens that to the behavior of terrorists on September 11th just a few years ago. Well, there are all sorts of disanalogies between these things. One was a series of wars that took place between national entities that were also religiously motivated, but not in the way that, say, Islamo-fascist terrorists today are. There's a kind of dishonesty about that.
Now, you mentioned earlier that he, near the end of the book, does permit for what he calls spirituality, not
right.
religious beliefs, but spirituality.
That's
again,
right.
How would you characterize what he will permit by way of spirituality?
Well, I think that he is sensitive to a concern that some readers would have. If we get rid of religion altogether, we'll end up with this sort of desiccated secularist point of view that's not going to provide our lives with much in the way of meaning and purpose and a compass for life and for living. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be similar to what Bertrand Russell said when he said that humanity is just an accidental collocation of atoms. If that's all we are, then what does it all mean? And he wants to say that life is richer than that, and somehow something more purposeful supervenes on all this physical stuff and gives us some meaningful reason to live. So I think he needs to bring spirituality back in, partly for that reason. Otherwise, his message of criticism is going to be interpreted as, you know, basically bringing us to the precipice with nothing to put in its place.
I've got to wonder if he believes that people like me, like you, cannot be persuaded by rational arguments or evidence, that our religious beliefs have blinded us or enabled us or disabled us to deal with these things. Why write a book about it?
I wondered that while I was reading the book. You know, sometimes you just got to get it off your chest, I guess, and say what you think, even if you're not convinced it will do any good. And even if your own argument implies that it can't do any good. That was a thought that I had quite a bit of the time myself. And yet I think because he keeps coming back to the need to be reasonable, and he, in his own way, tries to make an argument and present evidence in favor of his position, he deep down believes that he can convince people to change their minds. And though he probably doesn't think he'll change everybody's mind, he might be successful in making a difference because some people will change their minds.
Dr. Doug Guyvid is professor of philosophy at Talbot School of Theology. We've been doing a review of the book, The End of Faith, by Sam Harris. Dr. Guyvid is author of several books, including his latest, In Defense of Miracles. He's also written an article in the Christian Research Journal titled The End of Reason, Secularism, Paranoia, and the Folly of Sam Harris. Dr. Guyvid, thanks for being our guest.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right, when we come back from this break, we've got just a half hour of Issues Etc. ahead for you. We're going to continue a series that we've been doing with Dr. Uwe Simonetto, regular guest on the program, on lay vocation. Now, to most people, if you're just joining us on this subject, vocation sounds like going and learning how to do a trade. Not so. The scriptural teaching of vocation, that is, your calling, is, oddly enough, one of the most comforting teachings of Scripture. We live before God by faith and before our neighbor in love, or as Luther liked to put it in a more particular way for the Christian, we live in Christ by faith and in the neighbor in love. We'll find out a little bit more about what that means, and we'll talk about the vocation of spouse right after this.
Defending the faith. Teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc. You'll find lots of wonderful illustrations in our Issues Etc. book of the month for March. It's titled He is Risen Indeed. This picture book for children ages 4 and up depicts the drama of Passion Week in words from Scripture. He is Risen Indeed is published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this book on our website, issuesetc.org. He is Risen Indeed costs $12.99 plus shipping and handling. David Erickson's paintings capture the events of Good Friday and Easter morning in He is Risen Indeed. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. He is Risen Indeed will help children learn about Jesus' suffering, death, and resurrection. Looking for an Easter gift for a young child, grandchild, or godchild? He is Risen Indeed, our Issues Etc. book of the month for March. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
Our brains getting bigger or smaller?
Answers with Ken Ham, one of North America's most in-demand speakers on the authority of the Bible.
Ken, I hope you're not going to tell me my brain is shrinking, are you?
Well, Mark, we won't go there. For years, evolutionists have claimed that we originated from small-brained, ape-like creatures. Then, as we grew more intelligent over time, our brains supposedly grew larger as well. A scientist from the University of Adelaide in Australia claims that he has proof that there's been a 10% reduction in the size of our brains over the past few thousand years. Now, he claims that brain size is not related to intelligence, but to muscle mass. He says that since we've developed so much technology, we no longer need as much muscle, so our brains are shrinking. This is supposedly all a part of our continuing evolution. Actually, it wouldn't surprise me if our brains were getting smaller, but not because we're evolving as technology increases. All of us are suffering from 6,000 years of the curse. The judgment because of sin. Everything is running down, not improving. As we suffer from more and more mutations, we're losing more and more information. Sorry, but I have to tell you, we're devolving, not evolving.
The book of Genesis can be a powerful tool in sharing our faith. That's the theme of Ken Ham's new booklet called Effective Evangelism. It's just been posted to our website, AnswersRadio.com. It's a free service of the radio ministry of AnswersRadio.com.
The niche specialty of LCMS World Relief, along with disasters getting 95% of the dollar given to aid victims, we are determined that that aid be very closely connected with local Christians, local congregations, so the connection between Christ and caring for people is one that remains together. That's who Christ was. He loved people, word and deed. That's what the church does, I'm convinced, on the basis of the New Testament.
That's Pastor Matt Harrison, Executive Director of LCMS World Relief. For more information, look for the LCMS World Relief logo on our website, issuesetc.org, or call 314-996-1683. LCMS World Relief. Oh, light your
way. Mornings on AM 850 KFUO offer you a Christian way to start your weekday. Hi, I'm Paul Clayton, inviting you to hear your inspirational Christian favorites, great guests, and the information you need to prepare you for the road ahead. And after the morning show at 9:30, stick around for Focus on the Family on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back. Here in the last half hour of the program, we continue an ongoing conversation with Dr. Uwe Simonetto on lay vocation. There's so many places you can go with a subject like this, and one that we've, you know, it's odd, we've been talking for weeks and weeks, and this is one that we have not touched upon yet. That is the vocation of the spouse. It kind of covers the two fronts of both husband and wife, but also is closely connected to another vocation, that of parent as well. Dr. Uwe Simonetto is a regular guest on the program. He's an international journalist and director of the Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation. Uwe, welcome back.
Wonderful to be here.
Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. One of the things that struck me in the column that you had written recently on the vocation of spouse is that in a what's widely considered a Christian nation, the United States, the Christians of the Christians, the inner circle of the Christians, at least according to George Barna, the evangelicals, they have a divorce rate that is slightly higher than the national average. That's someone would say, well, that's surprising. This inner circle of Christians should have a higher view of marriage and of their spouse than this.
Yes, it's surprising to me, too. I think it might have something to do with this with a doctrine of glory, a theology of glory. You know, it's all accomplished, it's all done, so not much can happen to us. It's me and God, and it's not you, me and you and God. It's me and God, and so therefore, since Christ has come into my life, I'm fine, I'll be fine forever, amen. I think it's something to do with that. Because if you had a theology of the cross here, it wouldn't be quite that easy. It is the me culture that is producing this.
I want you to talk about your personal experience, if you would. You were raised, at least in your childhood, in Germany. And I think you've mentioned your father several times here on the program. Your father was a lawyer, if I'm not mistaken. Am I correct?
He was a blind lawyer, war blind, from the First World War.
Your mother, talk about her as we get into this conversation about the vocation of Spanish.
Well, my mother was a singer, oratorio singer, Bach specialist, Lieder singer. But she was also probably a precursor of today's postmodern woman. It's me, 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 me. And, I mean, a typical example is that she divorced my father, who certainly wasn't an easy man, I wouldn't say that, but she divorced my father at a time when even non-Christians would be nuts to divorce their spouses, which was at the end of World War II when Germany collapsed, when we were bombed out, when the Russians invaded Eastern Germany where we lived, when the one thing a sane family should do is stick together. This is not even a Christian consideration, it just makes sense. She divorced my father because she thought this was her great chance to succeed in her craft or in her art as a singer. One of the many reasons, obviously, as I said, he wasn't easy. And she, I would say that my mother was the quintessential, the first postmodern woman that I've ever encountered. She once told me that she had aborted every child but me, and was at one point she said, rather said, we missed you, but you were stronger than that. I mean, it was, it had a lot to do with it. Mind you, my opposition to abortion is probably most deeply rooted in that experience that one's own mother told one way, you know, every time I had sex, I had my uterus massaged to make sure that that I wouldn't have a baby.
Hmm. This is kind of introduces the whole perversion that has come into Western society.
Correct.
Of what it means to be a spouse. You mentioned before that it is not, for the evangelical, it's not me and you and God. It is just me and God. And so you might make my life a little better. But if you're getting in my way, I can do away with you, especially if you're my spouse.
Well, I would not say the evangelical, but this particular right. type of evangelical, because obviously they are wonderfully faithful evangelicals, and I know a lot of those who stick it out with their wives and or their husbands. But yes, there is this. It's you know, I'm saved. I've accepted Christ into my life. I've saved, and so all I have to do is go back to Christ, and that's it. You know, I'm saved. Well, I believe that there's more to what Luther called the fruits of faith than just saying, well, I'm saved, and even if I divorce, I'm saved. That is, of course, what we are suffering from in any form of Western culture, American or otherwise, that the me counts and the you, and therefore the thou, count less.
Marriage today has become, in the popular mindset, a means to an end. That is, a means to personal fulfillment, which probably accounts for the divorce rate such as it is,
right.
and the unhappiness of many marriages that do remain together. You talked about the theology of the cross.
Right.
In marriage. In fact, we've had other guests. Dr. David Adams has talked about the same thing.
Yeah.
I think we had him on to talk about the commandment against adultery, and he said the reason this is broken is because we have forgotten that marriage is lived under the cross.
Correct.
Marriage is not always a blissful institution, but it is nonetheless God-pleasing.
Correctly. It is the, I would even say it is of all the of all the vocations, it's the most God-pleasing. because marriage marriage spans both realms. The spiritual, obviously, with your wife, you are Christians, you pray together, you go to church together, and of course you are at the same time very much part of this realm. We have to live by way of reason, even if we disagree, even if we have doubts, we still have to apply reason. And the problem, you see, I am, after all, running an institute on lay vocation. The problem is that the vocation to the secular part of life is not recognized and not given its due, sadly, even among Lutherans.
Luther's view of marriage was, at the time, for a doctor of the church, revolutionary.
Right.
He got it from none other than St. Paul.
Correct, yeah.
But you point out that at the time, the church and the popular piety of the people gave a superior status to the celibate,
right,
to the unmarried, to the person devoted entirely to God. And Luther came in armed with God's word and drew a very different picture of marriage and the family. Paint that picture for us.
Well, the picture is that the human being is one. The flesh and the spirit, the body and the soul, they're one. You can't separate the two. And so, therefore, it is clear that the flesh is willed by God. God who created us body and soul and spirit. So, therefore, you cannot just dismiss the fleshly side of the human being because it is inferior. Because then you would be accusing God of having created something inferior, namely the flesh. This is, of course, nonsense. And St. Paul has taught us that, and Luther has rediscovered it. And in the long run, of course, the other Protestants, even the Catholics by now, are accepting that. But I think it is the major Lutheran contribution the major Lutheran anthropology.
We're talking with Dr. Uwe Simonetto. He's an international journalist, director of the Concordia Seminary Institute on lay vocation. We continue our conversation with him on lay vocation. Today, the vocation of spouse. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Kathy calls from St. Charles. Kathy, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you for taking my call. Appreciate your conversation. I've always found the teaching, the Lutheran understanding, biblical, scriptural understanding of vocation so helpful. And this particular one that you're talking about with spouse, I've seen in a situation very close to our family where someone had asked me who was a Christian, evangelical, I would say more Baptist-leaning. She had filled out a particular sheet looking for her particular gifts, and she was then supposed to ask for prayer for God's secret hidden will to be revealed to her so she would know how to use these gifts for her Lord. And so I was trying to explain that this God's will is not secret or hidden. It's to love God and love your neighbor, and that it's where he has placed you. But this particular person really ran with this this teaching of, and they took it to its logical conclusion and devoted themselves to that particular secret, what they found, what's their secret hidden will, and it broke up their marriage.
And did this person consider that part of God's will that the marriage should suffer so that she could enact her gifts?
Well, she felt like that the her partner was to do whatever it took so she could fulfill her part of God's will for her life, and if he didn't concur with it, she even went as so far as the last 2 years of their marriage they had no relations. It was she took it to its logical conclusion. She believed what her church taught. But, he just he didn't agree and felt that they needed to be husband and wife first, and it broke up their marriage.
Kathy, thanks for the call. Uwe, sad story.
Very sad story, and but, you know, what Kathy has described here is really what I've been saying. It's me Christianity. It's very strange, you know. It's me, 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 me. It's my fulfillment. It is, of course, very Calvinist, too, because it is my salvation, not your salvation. It's mine. It's my relationship with God. That's the Westminster Confession. And I think it is tragic because this is an egregious error, theological error, that has been committed there. And this is something that I hope to God the evangelicals and the Calvinists will rethink very rapidly, because it is, therein lies the answer to the question, why is it that that there are so many divorces among the evangelicals? More divorces than among the non-religious, even.
Joe calls from his car. Joe, thank you for waiting. Welcome.
Hi, I have a question that kind of ties in with your guest comment about Luther changing the view of marriage. And I had read somewhere that after the time of Constantine, when you basically had a state religion where everyone was Christian, that was the foundation for the development of the monastic lifestyles and taking vows of chastity, poverty, and things like that, because people had to be serious Christians, and the only way to do that was to enter that type of lifestyle or something. Is that accurate?
Joe, thank you very much for the question.
I don't think so.
So, in other words, Joe says he had heard that the monastic lifestyle grows up out of the legalization of Christianity, people striving to be not just state Christians, but true enthusiastic Christians, something along those lines. You don't think so?
No, I mean, St. Jerome, of course, St. Jerome stressed the celibacy, but of course well before Christianity became a changed a state church, you had stylites, and you had monastics of various various shapes and forms. It is true, however, that that Jerome schlepping all those Roman noble women to Jerusalem to live in a sort of monastic or a celibate way had a lot to do with it. But I don't think it is just because Christianity became a state religion that Christianity then also became an anti-fleshly religion. There was monasticism well before that, and of course there had been monasticism well before Christianity.
Luther at one point says that marriage enjoys highest place among all the estates that God has established, up to and including emperor and bishop.
Correct.
He held it in this highest regard. Why did he do this? And why did Luther, a latecomer to marriage himself, but then afterwards an enthusiastic proponent, but why did Luther regard marriage so highly? What did he feel was at stake?
Well, what was at stake was really the order of creation. Marriage is an order of creation, as is the state. But it is the one order of creation that if you don't have marriage, you will have no ongoing civilization. You will have no process of civilizing the offspring, of creating the offspring and civilizing the offspring. Furthermore, whereas marriage spans both kingdoms, the spiritual and the secular, the bishops are just involved in the spiritual, and the emperors would be running the secular. But here in marriage, you're both. You're squarely rooted in both realms, and you're bridging the two realms. And so, therefore, it is so infinitely more important.
We wouldn't be complete if we didn't mention the relationship of the vocation of spouse, of husband and wife, to that of father and mother, to parents.
Well, absolutely, yes.
Outline that relationship. They are when there are parents, they are of necessity father and mother, and husband and wife in God's will. But they don't necessarily go together. There can be husbands and wives who, for one reason or another, have no children. But what's the basic relationship that's envisioned between those two vocations? They overlap so much.
Those two vocations and the vocation of a parent. Well, clearly it is, look, God created the world from nothing. From this order, he created order. And, of course, in creating marriage as an order of creation, he assured the ongoing creation, because the process of creation has not been completed. We were created as his cooperators in the process of ongoing creation. This occurs, obviously, in the sexual relationship, but it also occurs in transmitting to children our civilization, our culture, our faith, what basically constitutes the human being and what basically constitutes created order.
Does this mean, you've talked about marriage in terms of the order of creation,
right,
that divorce is intrinsically a disordered situation?
Definitely, yes.
Talk about if marriage is lived under the cross by Christian husband and wife, is in fact, for better or for worse, the term that we like to use, for better or for worse, God's will and God's way of ordering society.
Right.
When divorce intervenes, what is the effect on, first of all, those most affected, children, and then on the greater society?
Well, we know, it's a sociological fact, that the children of divorced parents have a harder time at school, have a harder time civilizing, have a harder time finding their own roots, finding themselves, do badly at school. At its very worst, you will find that juvenile delinquents more often than not are the offspring of divorce. The same applies, of course, to abortions. Girls who are the daughters of a divorced family, a divorced couple, are more likely to have a divorce than other young women. It is the entire order of our civilization goes awry when you break up the marriage. And I know this in my own life, because I've never really overcome the fact that my parents divorced when I was 10 or 9. And it caused immense complications in my own life, which thankfully I have overcome. But it caused immense complications. And you know, you feel, as a child of a divorced couple, you almost feel inferior. You feel inferior, in fact. You watch the other children. They have happy families. They pray together. They eat together. They go out together. They go for walks in the park together. They do all sorts of things together. You're not there. And you suddenly feel that you're guilty for the state of affairs you're living in as an 11-year-old kid, when, in fact, you had nothing to do with it. And then very often, that happened in my case, and one parent, in that case my mother, turns around, sort of keeps blaming you. Well, if you weren't there, this wouldn't have happened. And what is even worse, even in cases where divorcing couples say, well, we'll stay friends for the kids' sake, ultimately the differences between the two are played out at the back of their children. Parents, divorcing parents, cannot help telling their children that daddy was bad or mom was bad and was wrong. And suddenly you have to take sides. And I now, in retrospect, I'm almost 70, reflect very shamefully about my own attitude vis-a-vis my father, because I was brought up more with my mother, although she wasn't there either. I was in a boarding school, but she was the focus of my life. And I somehow did not give my father his due, who was a blind man, blind in World War I, and probably desired my love, which I couldn't give him because I was in the middle. Mm-hmm. I think it is so horrible, and I don't know of any situation where divorce went so smoothly that the offspring didn't suffer some form of egregious consequence.
Very briefly, we should mention a proper response to the attempts here in the United States, and it's also taken place in Europe as well in various places, to redefine marriage, the proponents would say to broaden the definition of marriage, yeah, to include others other than man and woman, but also same-sex marriage. Your final thoughts there, if you could keep it as clean as possible.
Well, I'll keep it clean. I just think it is it goes to show that we're living in a totally depraved society.
All right, I'll let it suffice.
Let me go with that. I mean, I could say something that you wouldn't be able to broadcast on the airwaves here.
All right. Uwe Simonetto, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thanks.
Folks, you can read an article written by Uwe titled Called to Be a Spouse. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click links, and you'll find if you scroll down, you'll find a direct link to Uwe Simonetto and the Concordia Seminary Institute on lay vocation. issuesetc.org is our website. Well, next Monday, Uwe will join us again. We're going to talk about this is a great topic, how to write a letter to the editor, not just how to write one, but how to write one that will get read and maybe even published. We'll talk about that next Monday with Uwe. Tomorrow on the program, Sunday School, Deaconess Pam Nielsen is going to join us. You know, there was a famous book about 10, 15, 20 years ago, Everything I ever learned, I learned in kindergarten, something like that. Well, I have often reflected as a pastor that some of the greatest misconceptions I have ever believed about what God's Word teaches, about what Bible passages mean or say, what Bible stories are really all about, those greatest misconceptions were sadly gained in Sunday school. Now, it wasn't my Sunday school teacher's fault. Very often it was those who wrote the Sunday school material. We'll be talking with Deaconess Pam Nielsen tomorrow on the program about how to bring God's Word to our children in a way that doesn't candy coat the stories of the Bible and does not omit the very basic things like a proper distinction between law and gospel and a Christ-centered, cross-focused. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc. Stay tuned for Pastor Tom Baker. He's back again for a second full week of Law and Gospel here on AM 850 KFUO.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.